Ladies and gentlemen, we are here with Dolores Logsdon today, who's a mother, a grandmother, an author of the book So You Hate to Cook. She is a remarkable, what's called non-agerian, who's lived through the first Great Depression, who has incredible stories about motherhood, running several businesses, what it's like to live through the Depression, what it's like to author a book when you're just under 90, what it's like to assist troubled teens who are pregnant and unwedded and not even old enough to work. She's a wonderful woman and a delight to many who she's had the privilege to assist and who've been assisted by her. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Dolores Logsdon to It's Rainmaking Time Broadcasting. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think the first question I wanted to ask you is, how many children do you have and how many grandchildren do you have?
I have 5 children, 17 grandchildren, and a whole bunch of great-grandchildren.
That's amazing. That's a lot of children.
Yes, it is.
And a lot of grandchildren.
They're wonderful.
What made you author a book in your 80s?
Because I like to write. And I like to read, so the two kind of go together.
But why on cooking?
Pardon me?
Why did you write a book on cooking?
Oh, because I love to cook, and I've cooked a lot, and I know how to cook.
Who is this book for? Who should buy this book?
Oh, I think anybody should buy the book. Anybody. If you are a good cook, I think you would gain something from it. Or if you don't know how to cook at all, I think you would gain from it.
Why did you name it So You Hate to Cook?
Because I thought that maybe some people would get their attention. Because there are a lot of people who hate to cook, and maybe this would help them.
What are a couple of the recipes? What are some of the names of some of the recipes that are in that book? Like, if I bought the book, what could I cook? What could I learn how to cook using it?
Oh, very simple things. And then some very difficult things, too. Some very simple things like how to mash potatoes. Or some very hard things like making goulash.
Wow. I don't know how to make either one. Which is why I'm mashing out some broadcasting. The way I cook is with broadcasting and communication. But you do, too, because you authored a book before I did.
You're a remarkable lady.
Yeah, you're a remarkable lady. Talk to us a little bit about the early part of your life growing up in the Great Depression. Share with audiences what it was like for you, what you noticed, what you saw, what concerned you.
During the Great Depression, there were not any jobs for anybody. I don't care if you're a professor or a chimney sweeper. There were just no jobs for anybody. My dad, who is very astute man, very smart man, went door to door sharpening knives in order to get enough food on our table.
How did you feel about him having to go door to door sharpening knives?
I was young and I didn't think much about it. As long as we had our tummies full, I think that we didn't care how he did it.
How did your dad feel in those days?
He was very disgraced. He was a very proud man, and it was very hard for him not to get a job and not to be able to provide better for his family.
And how did your mom feel about it?
She accepted it. And in fact, then it was very uncommon for women to do work outside the home at all. And she would go to other people's homes and do housework, which is very demeaning for her, but we managed very well. We never went without a meal, and they were both hard workers, and we got through it fine.
When you say it was demeaning for her to do housework, why in those days was it demeaning for her?
Because to be a maid was sort of looked on as not being for the upper class a job. You weren't a maid for anybody if you were well and smart. So, but she did it, and she did a good job.
So it was a big deal for her to shift her thinking to bring in money.
Yes, it was. I don't think that she cared how she got it, as long as she provided, as long as her children were provided well for.
Did you enjoy your childhood during the Depression? In other words, was there still a sense of joy, or was it all hardship?
No, I enjoyed. I can remember enjoying going to school and singing and playing, and it wasn't all hardship, no. I think it was harder on the parents than it was on the children, because they didn't realize what a hard time it was for the parents to provide.
Did you sense any struggle with your parents? Like, could you feel them struggling, or was it, like, invisible to you?
I think we lived just about the same. I can't remember any difference. They both went about their jobs, and we lived just about the same as usual.
What do you think got your family through the hard times?
Being together in prayer and working together got us through it.
Where did you grow up?
In Minnesota.
And did you work on your parents' property, or did you help out in the family? Like, what kind of things did you do?
It was on a farm, and we grew straw and raised potatoes and did farm work and had cows and horses and pigs. It was a hard life, but we never went hungry one meal.
You had all your food right there.
Yes. Yes, we would go uptown to the grocery store once a week and buy sugar and coffee, but most everything we grew right on the farm, and either canned it or put it in the cellar.
Is that where your love of cooking began?
I don't know. I don't know where it began, but I do love to cook. And I've always cooked all my life, and I don't know where it began, but I suppose it was there.
What brought your family, what caused your family to move away from the farm?
My dad raised pigs. That was our big income. And they would be shipped to Chicago. And he called Chicago and said, how much are pigs bringing a pound? And they said 3 cents a pound. And what was the going rate to get them there? 3 cents a pound. So there wasn't any profit at all in all that work. So he didn't see any sense in raising pigs because there was no profit.
So then what happened?
Then we just all loaded up in the mobile and started out for California.
Weren't you scared?
Well, I wasn't. I thought it was a big adventure, but I'm sure my mother was.
What did she say about it?
Well, he wanted to go to California because he had an aunt who lived in California. And she talked about all the good things that were happening there, jobs and so on. But my mother would not let us go that far. So we just went about 200 miles south to a place in Iowa where we spent 4 years.
And how was that?
Oh, I loved it, but it was very, very difficult for my parents. My mother, who never worked in her life, I'm outside the home. I started cleaning houses, and my dad went from door to door sharpening knives, anything to get money enough for food. It was very, very difficult times and very demeaning for these two smart people to do such uncommon work.
Were you embarrassed?
Was I embarrassed? No. No, I wasn't. Never.
How about your sisters and brothers?
I don't think so. I don't think so. We all just went on about our lives. And I know my mother was embarrassed, but not us kids.
So you're in Iowa, and you are there 4 years, and then what happens?
Well, my dad still kept pushing to go to California. That was his aim all his life, was to go to California. And after 4 years of bad economy and just barely getting along, my mother agreed. And so we started in the old Hutmobile with a trailer behind with our, some of our furniture in it.
That's amazing.
And our clothes, and all of us stacked in the car, and away we came.
And was there a sense of excitement in the air?
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness, yes. We kids thought it was wonderful, you know, just the adventure of it.
Right. Okay, so you get to California, and what happens in your life?
Well, I was a teenager, and I was through high school, but I went to Santa Monica Junior College and worked at a restaurant and worked night and day. And my parents did better in California. They found jobs right away, and living was easier because there was more activity, more going on, more jobs, and it was a better life.
So you get a job in restaurants, you're working day and night, and then what happens?
Well, let's see, what did happen? I went to school full-time, and I worked at night at this restaurant from 4 till 12, and it was right by the Olympic Stadium, and I was all alone in this little restaurant, so I did all the cooking and the waiting on people. And when the people would come out from an event at the Olympic Stadium, that little place would just be packed with people. And I was there all by myself, but I managed because it was just very small between the counter and the place where the people came in. And behind the counter was a very small place. But I was, when the event would turn out at the stadium, the place would just be packed for about half an hour. And after that was over, then I would clean up the place and get out there about 1:30. And then I would go home and grab a couple of hours sleep before 8 o'clock class. Was busy, busy times.
Wow. That's an incredibly packed life. So where did you meet your husband?
Well, you know, I love to dance. So after I would close the restaurant at 12 o'clock, there were two dance halls on the beach. And I was on Pico Boulevard, not too far from the beach. So I would walk down to the dance hall and maybe dance two or three dances before I went home and went to bed. But I was at the dance hall, and this very handsome fellow came up and asked me to dance. And boy, that was it from then on. It was like magic. Yes, it was.
Did you know right away you'd marry him?
Oh, I didn't know that. No. No. I don't think he did either.
So how long did you dance before you got married?
I would say maybe 6 months.
6 months of dancing?
Oh, no, not a lot of dancing, no, because I worked so late and he worked. So, you know, there wasn't much time for romance. It was mostly in the car, any romance that it was.
Wow, TMI. Okay.
I just lived in a room, so I could hardly take him to my house. And he lived with his parents about 30 miles away, which at that time was a long ways.
Cars, at least you have some privacy to a point. So you get married, right?
Yes, we did get married.
And how long was it before you had your first child?
Probably 9 months and 2 days.
9 months and 2 days?
I'm just kidding. It wasn't long, I'll tell you.
I was going to say, it sounds like there was one like ready to go, shake and bake.
Yeah, his parents didn't approve because I was Catholic, and my parents didn't approve because he wasn't Catholic.
So nobody had approval.
No.
There were sparks, and you wanted to marry each other.
Yeah, we did. We loved each other, and we had a happy marriage.
And how long were you married before he passed away?
Well, we had 4 children, so it must have been at least 4 years. It wasn't long, though. The children are very close together.
You became a widow at what age?
I would say maybe 26 or 27.
That's very young to be a widow.
Yes.
How did you feel?
I felt very badly because we were very much in love. And how to take care of a family, a big family, at age when I didn't have a lot of education was the problem, and how to take care of them. And I wanted to take care of them myself. I didn't want to burden my family or his family. So we managed.
How did you manage?
I bought a little restaurant, and I worked at this restaurant, and then I got to know the owner quite well. So I got it with very little down payment, and I had that little restaurant for a year or so, and then I bought a big restaurant about a mile or two down the street, and the name of it was the Gulf Burger, and it was right across from Pierce College, and a lot of college students came there, and it was right close to a golf course, and a lot of the golfers came, so it was a busy, busy life.
I'll bet you met a lot of people.
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness, yes.
And I hear they love your pies.
Well, that's what I was known for, was the pies. And every night after I closed the shop, I would, and a couple others would bake the pies for the next day and set them out there. And by the next night, they'd all be gone.
What were the pies that people love that you made? Name them.
Apple and pumpkin and cherry.
So you're in the restaurant business, and how did you get into real estate?
Because I knew that I had to make some money, extra money, with a growing family and getting them through school and providing with them enough.
When you got into real estate, how did you juggle being in real estate and your restaurant?
Not easily. There was a real estate office close by, and the realtors would come in there to eat, and I got to know them, and they kept saying that I should get into real estate because it would be easier. So with their encouragement, little by little, I sold the restaurant and got into real estate.
Was it hard to let go of the restaurant?
Oh, yes, it was. That's what I really like to do, is cook and serve people. I love being in a restaurant. And it was my own little realm. I did okay in real estate, but I'm not as successful as I was in the restaurant. I mean, money-wise, probably I made more, but it was not as happy, not as fulfilling as I loved to be in the restaurant.
Do you feel you got talked out of your calling? Your calling was to cook and to serve and to host.
I think so.
And that you got talked into real estate to make money. Then you went in. Didn't you make a lot of money in real estate?
Well, I'd make a bunch, and then I wouldn't there'd be dry times where I wouldn't make any at all. So I had to be very careful how I spent the money to save. And of course, these were depression times, so there wasn't a lot of money anywhere.
But I think I remember years ago, or in the years past, you shared that you made a lot of money in real estate and then something happened and you lost it. Would you be willing to share that with the public, like what you learned from that?
I learned that you cannot spend every cent you have. You have to save some for the future because you don't know what is to come up in the future, whether good times or bad times. And the depression was really, really bad. Nobody had jobs. Nobody had money to spend. But we got through it. We never missed a meal. Never went without anything that we really needed.
You shared with me, and I'm going to paraphrase what you said. This is like months ago we had a talk. And you said to me that, I think it was you that said it to me, that there was also a time during the Great Depression where you weren't allowed to sell certain things. You weren't allowed to do certain businesses. Things were just being closed.
Yes, tis true.
Can you explain it?
Well, there was a lot of business failures because people weren't buying, and you can't pay the rent if you're not selling anything. So people weren't buying, and so there weren't a lot of sales, money coming in. So it was a very, very difficult time for everybody, not just rich people or poor people, but everybody had a hard time during the Depression.
What do you think a depression is? I mean, you're 90 years old. What is your definition of what the Depression was that you lived through?
I think the Depression was a very hard time for everybody, but I think it was harder on the people who couldn't adjust to it, couldn't adjust to living a little less, buying less, and not going out as much, not eating out as much, not buying such expensive clothes. It was very hard for some people to adjust to a lower scale of living.
If people did not become afraid and contract during that time, don't you think that by not contracting and not being afraid and to go ahead and move your money, not at the expense of saving it, would have helped a lot of people if people would have still continued to do business and buy goods and services and put their faith in the present and the future instead of contract and hold back in fear? Don't you think it would have helped industry?
I think so. I think you're right. There was just nothing happening. Nobody was buying or selling. It was just in the doldrums. There was not a lot going on anywhere in industry or in stores. It was really a bad slump.
Right. And don't you think because at that time there was more manufacturing here, there was more retail jobs here, that, you know, jobs now have been subcontracted out to other countries, and we are in the age of industrialization, and we're in the age of computer advancement and exponentiating development with the digital age. And because of that, there's a whole industrial new complex of jobs related to computers and computer industry software, hardware, the digitization and the...
I think you're right.
So that wasn't here then. That wasn't here yet, where everybody had a computer as if they have a telephone, like it's the same type of perception. So there were whole industrial complexes that weren't even available to people. The first half of your life, men viewed computers as something that women use, not something that they use. And did you know that when the perception of using a computer or a keyboard changed for men, thus came the exponentiation of the use of computers once the perception changed. But as long as the perception was that that's a female job, that's a job relegated to only women, it was not an attraction for most men during the time of the first 50 years and 70 years of your life. Did you know that?
Yes, I think you're right. Absolutely right.
So you had five children, you are 4 years into your marriage, and your husband dies. How does he pass away?
He died of a heart attack, and we rushed him to the hospital, and he lived 8 days, and then he died. He was young.
How old was he?
I think 31, but I'm not sure.
That's incredibly young.
Yes, it is.
Did you ever think he would remarry?
No. I was busy, believe me.
What does that mean?
That means that I was too busy to even think about it. With all my children and my job and everything else, I couldn't think about romance. But I did go dancing. I worked at this restaurant and got off at 12 o'clock. And I didn't have a car. And this was on Lincoln Boulevard in Santa Monica. And I walked down to the beach where the dance halls were. There were three there in a row, right on the beach. And after I got off work at 12 o'clock, I would walk down there and dance for an hour and then walk home. But
talk about your work a little bit with young teens who got pregnant mothers. Share a little bit about that. You spent many, many years helping teenagers. Talk about that.
I knew that there were many, many girls who were pregnant and wanted to keep their babies, but they had no sense, nowhere to live, and no place to, they couldn't work after so long. So I opened up my own house for, and I had two or three pregnant girls there, and then more kept coming. So I got one house, and at the end I had 10 houses, and over 1,000 babies were born at these houses. I would go from house to house and see that everything was in order, that they had enough food. One morning early, I usually visited them in the afternoon, but one morning early I went, and at this house, instead of one girl in the bedroom, there was one girl and one man in each bedroom. So then I made a rule that there could be no men at all that could come on the premises. So that made it very difficult for the girls because they wanted their boyfriends. But I had to make the rule because it wasn't a place for men to be. It was a place for pregnant women.
So what ended up happening with these houses? You got done managing 10 properties and you were taking care of pregnant mothers. And then what happened?
Well, I think probably that it was just too intensive. Besides, I don't know if that's when I met my husband or not. I can't remember if that was why I got out of that business or not. But I think it probably was that I met him. After I closed the restaurant, that little restaurant on Pico, I would walk down to the dance hall, which is about a mile, and I met my husband there, and we fell in love immediately. And that was it.
Do you miss your husband?
Uh-huh, at the dance. And then from that time, he would pick me up at the restaurant when I get off at midnight, and then we'd go down and dance. They closed at 1 o'clock, maybe it's 2, I don't know, but whatever time it was. And then he'd take me to my room, which also was on Pico Boulevard. And that went on for some time, and then we got married and lived happily ever after.
At 90 years of age, you've had a quadruple bypass, and your life has become more day-to-day, more focused on the day-to-day. Am I correct?
I think so.
Is there something that you can, some things you can share with audiences about what it is to be 90 today and wisdom that you can share with us?
Well, I think that one has to live each day as it comes and not be too upset with the ups and downs of the days, just to take it in stride and not be too upset over little spats or economic ups and downs, but just take each day as it comes and live life as fully as you can.
Is there other things you'd like to share about other lessons?
Other lessons? I think we should strive to be happy. It's no use having this wonderful life if we're unhappy all the time. So do things that make you pleased. Do things that you can accomplish, that you know that you did something worthwhile during the day. Not just live the day, but make it a day worth living.
Are there things at 90 you still want to do?
Oh, I would like to do a lot more things. Oh, my goodness, yes.
Let's hear it.
I would like to help more people. I would like to be richer. I would like to be of more worth to this world.
What do you mean by that?
To make a greater impact on the world, to be of some worth to something or somebody, to make it better, a better place to live.
Do you feel that at 90 you're not able to do that?
I don't do much of anything, I'll tell you that. I wish I could do more.
Give me an example of what would improve the quality of your days.
Oh, my goodness. I have a wonderful day. Angel takes very good care of me, and I don't lack a thing.
I know you're grateful, but if God tapped you on the shoulder and said, "Hey, Dolores, is there anything you'd like? Would you like a computer? Would you like to travel? Would you like to live in a new location?" And you could blink your eyes, and God said, "Look, I know you're grateful, but is there anything else you'd like?" What would you say?
I don't think I lack anything. I think that I'm happy. I think Angel takes excellent care of me. What could I want for more?
Do you want to travel?
I don't think that I'm up to it anymore. No, I'm just fine, just the way I am.
Wonderful. And do you know how much you're contributing by sharing about your life with others on the internet from different parts of the world who can tune in and listen to you?
I hope, but I don't see how.
Well, that's because you don't have your own computer yet.
No, Angel has one.
Yeah, but you need one. You need your own little laptop.
Yes, I agree with you. That would help. Angel, I said I wanted one, and she said, "You hardly know how to use your cell phone."
Yeah, but Angel may not know how simple it is to set it up for you to use. She may not know that.
No.
If there's anybody listening on It's Rainmaking Time who would like to make a contribution for a small laptop, a Apple laptop, their 13-inch laptop for Dolores Logsdon, please call the Rainmaking Company at 626-398-8652. We'd like to get Dolores a little Apple notebook and have it all set up for her to be on the computer or do her writing by Christmas. And by the way, Dolores, tell us about your new book.
I'm going to write about the Great Depression. I'm not as speedy with it as I used to get out a book and pretty fast, but it takes me a long time now. So I hope to have it written within a year.
Now, but Dolores, you do all your writing by hand, don't you?
Yes.
But do you know how to type?
Oh, I used to. I don't.
You could remember it. You could get it back.
I'm sure I know how, but I haven't for a long, long time.
Yeah, but if we could get you to learn how to type in a week, guess what? You could be typing your manuscript and have it ready on the internet in a few months.
I don't know about that.
Well, we would help you.
I'm not very speedy.
Well, we would help you become speedy.
Good.
And you would be called Speedy Logsdon.
Well, that would be the overstatement of the day.
Well.
And how are you, Kim?
I'm great. I'm doing broadcasting and love the show. And the beauty is that, you know, when I started broadcasting, not in television, but on the radio in 2004, after I did about 12 segments, the internet wasn't as popular as it was today. So after being turned down by the major networks for 4 years, I kind of put it on the back burner and thought, you know, I wouldn't see my time again. But I got inspired to go back and do my work in broadcasting and to interview and talk to people that I love, that I felt had an important story or message or life experience or expertise, even information that needed to be known. And that since I have this great love and a passion, that I'm going to do it and fill my days with passion and doing what I love to do, and let the financing of everything come as it will, and let God handle that part. So I don't handle that part, but God does for me.
You're a very wise lady.
Thank you. And speaking of which, I have a question that's kind of off the chart of the traditional day-to-day stuff. Talk about your faith. What has it been like to live a life of such deep, strong faith?
To have faith is very important in your life. I don't think it matters in whom you believe, but I think you should have faith in God and faith in your country, faith in your work, faith in your family. I think faith is very, very important for you to believe deeply.
You have great faith in God, don't you?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. He is the most important one in my life.
I know it may sound like a loaded question and like a question that's already kind of pre-plugged, but do you feel that faith, by having so much deep faith, that faith has carried you through very difficult circumstances of life?
Yes. Without it, I would have been lost many, many times. I wouldn't have been able to go on. No, faith carries you through. That's a great asset in your life, is to have faith.
You have a heart condition now, don't you?
Yes.
Okay. If you could transform that right now, from this point forward, that heart condition is gone. What are you doing? Describe your days.
Well, I think I would be more active for one thing. I would get out more and do more and write more and get more involved in helping people. I would do some good for the world instead of just lying here.
In the meantime, even though you're lying there, if you're broadcasting and you're writing and you're contributing to the people around you and you're in constant contact with people that you want to be in contact with, is it enough?
Is it enough? Mm-hmm. I'm not unhappy, I tell you that. I'm really very grateful to live such a long life. And I think maybe I've contributed a little bit and I've enjoyed my life. I'm very grateful to God for my family and for my friends and for my health.
If God were to take you any day now, would you be upset?
Oh, no, I'm ready.
You're ready to go?
Yes, I am.
I've never heard you say that.
I am, because I'm not contributing as much as I would like. I would like to do more, and I certainly don't contribute a lot to the world right now.
But what if we could create a way for you with broadcasting to do that?
It sounds pretty impossible.
All you need is a phone.
What would I broadcast?
Well, you would be one of our correspondents, our rainmaking ambassadors.
I probably could do that.
Would you like to do that?
Yes, I would.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to hear that Dolores Logsdon has just made herself available to be a rainmaking ambassador.
Thank you, Kim.
And we will be calling you on your cell phone with assignments.
Wonderful.
And for those of you listening to It's Rainmaking Time, I'm interviewing Dolores Logsdon, the author of So You Hate to Cook, a remarkable woman, 90 years old, sitting in her home in Saugus with a heart condition, who says she's ready to go because she wants to contribute more and doesn't feel that she is. So we want to bring in a little computer, get her started, and get her so that she has a tool to complete her next book on the Great Depression. And we want to be able to give her assignments of the creative, marvelous world that she can access through the internet while she's getting advanced information on how to improve her condition. If you are interested in assisting all of us in bringing Dolores online as a rainmaking ambassador, please call 626-398-8652. And Dolores Logsdon, we love you. You're a remarkable woman and a dear friend.
I love you, Kim. Thank you so much.
God bless you.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.